Hello and welcome to Taking Care of Business. I'm Jackie Mitchell. Most of our listeners will be very familiar with the term B2B and B2C. Well, today we're talking about a term that I'm a huge fan of and I think is the future of business success, particularly in this digital age, H2H or human to human. There's been endless studies now, although some business dinosaurs may think it's a new concept, that emotional intelligence ranks much higher than IQ. EQ separates great leaders from the pack. Today's show is made possible by our friends at the EView Group, Australia's first multi-brand real estate network. Now, a key element to any human-to-human, particularly in business, is the power of real confidence. Our first guest is a sought-after speaker, author, and award-winning coach. She has helped thousands of senior leaders and their teams learn to show up as the best version of themselves. I love that. To build their confidence and influence others. I'd like to give a very warm welcome to the show, Michelle Sales.
Hi, Jackie.
Hello. Great to have you here. Now, this is a topic that I'm really fascinated about, and I think it's a really key one. Particularly in this digital age that there has been such a focus on the importance of communication and relationships. And you talk about bouts of insecurity, that we've all had bouts of insecurity in the work environment. So how can we best deal with these moments when we're having those moments, or imposter syndrome is another popular topic of that. So how can we best deal with those moments?
Yeah, it's really important, and confidence is so critical to us all, and no matter what we're doing. The best thing I love about confidence, Jackie, is that it's not something that you're either born with or not. So it's very much a learnable skill, and that's just, I reckon, so empowering about confidence.
Mm,
But, you know, it does wax and wane for all of us. And so, you know, we can sometimes feel like we're on a bit of a roller coaster ride. So really having an awareness of when we are at our best and what is contributing to that, what's giving us confidence, because it is different for all of us. But the starting point is really having a good sense of awareness about when our confidence is higher and when is it lower and we need to boost it.
Yeah, so if we're in a meeting or we're pitching for business or there's some sort of business interaction and we can sort of have that awareness and then sense that lack of confidence is starting to overwhelm your performance. Are there any tips or tricks that we can use, any sort of mental sayings or self-talk that would help us?
Yeah, I like how you say self-talk, because I think that's one of the really key aspects of it, because we have on average 65,000 thoughts a day, which is massive. And if our self talk is negative or critical, too critical, or we're spending time comparing ourselves to other people and always finding us lacking, then we can go spiral downwards quite quickly. So catching ourselves, being really aware of that self-talk, reframing to what we're good at. So rather than trying to work on improving all the things that we don't do so well, really just thinking about what are my strengths, what do I know that I do well, what gives me energy, and then doing that. So, you know, if it's in the middle of a meeting, for example, think about how do I contribute in this meeting? What do I know? How can I do that? Think about your language so that you're not apologising and saying sorry before you even start speaking. All of those things are really important.
I think that's a really good tip, to not say sorry or draw attention to your weaknesses. You know, really focusing on what's strong, not what's wrong with you, I think is a really key bit. And I like this sort of self-awareness of your thoughts. So it's like you become a thought detective and monitoring your own thoughts, and then having, I suppose, a script or some inspiration in place, that self-talk, to talk yourself out of it. Is that sort of where you're coming from?
Yeah, absolutely. I love it.
Okay. Yes, I can tell. I love it too. Now, the thing is, I spend a lot of time with women in business, and I often get a lot of people chatting to me, particularly business women networking groups and leaders, saying that for their business women, confidence always comes up as their biggest challenge. Have you noticed any gender-related issues with that from a confidence perspective?
I have, and I run a number of women's leadership programs, and obviously the same as you, network with lots of women. So I think the short answer is yes, I do notice it. Mm. And I think there's a whole load of reasons for that. You know, stereotypes, the role that women feel that we've had to play at work over many years, particularly women who work in very male-dominated environments, and, you know, for just about their whole career they've looked up and haven't had female role models, have thought this is what it's for me to be successful here, and therefore perhaps have to show up in a way that's not really being true to themselves. Mm-hmm. And then every message they get kind of, you know, they're comparing themselves to that and finding themselves lacking. So confidence, I notice with women, particularly women in senior roles, kind of is chipped away at over many years.
So how do we turn that around? How can we actually, I suppose, promote or instill a bit more confidence in business women?
So understanding who you are and being true to that. So the real confidence you talked about at the beginning, the real is actually being really genuine and authentic about, you know, who you are, what do you value, what's important to you in life. If it's about speaking up for women, sometimes what I notice with women more than men is we hide our voice or are quieter in different forums because we are trying to avoid conflict or we have a fear of being judged. Mm. So being able to experiment with finding your voice in different situations and having people that support you and can offer you good feedback, all of those things really help, as well as finding some really good role models that we can look up to. I love that Madeleine Albright quote, you can't be what you can't see, and that's really for women. You know, if we don't have good role models that we can see that this is what it's going to take to be more confident or to speak up or to stand up for yourself, then that's hard.
Yeah, well, our brain as humans, we're wonderful pattern matchers and we're looking for patterns, and so we need those role models. We need to be taught this is how you do it, but also from people that you can relate to. So as much as Oprah is wonderful and a great role model, Hillary Clinton, and there's some great ones, you know, plenty around the world, plenty of women around the world, sometimes they can feel a little bit out of reach. So it's nice to actually look at someone and go, you know what, I can relate to them and they can do it, so maybe I might give it a go. Is that your experience? Have you noticed that?
Absolutely, they're relatable. And I love that where you started in this program, Human to Human, because it is absolutely relatable, able to connect to, able to kind of not see the things that you have to do to boost your confidence even as being out of reach. In fact, I talk about boosting or building confidence like building muscles. And we don't go to the gym and just start lifting 80 kilo hoops when we go to the gym, or I don't anyway. We actually start with smaller weights and we build up to it, and confidence is the same. We don't have to jump so far outside of our comfort zone to build confidence. The smaller, more actions that we take every day to boost confidence is actually much more sustainable for us, and that includes having role models that we can feel like we can connect to and see what those small actions are.
Yeah, and I think confidence has got a bad brand image, if I was to go down that path. I think when you start saying, you know, you need to build your confidence, you need to be more confident, a lot of people then think, oh, but that sounds like I'm love myself or I'm promoting myself too heavily. And, of course, we all know in Australian culture this tall poppy syndrome. And I've seen a lot of business people, men and women, learn a lot of stuff from the US, of course, that they're a leader in so many fields in business. And then they bring that format or the concept back into Australia and try to repackage it, but it doesn't work because it's sort of selling, not telling, I suppose, in a way, and it's too hard for our culture. So what can we do to overcome that fear of tall poppy, I suppose?
Yeah, and I think I really like what you say, and I think the other thing that I also think is in line with that is the fake it till you make it. I think, you know, sometimes we have to do that in the moment, but it only gets us so far for so long, and it can be exhausting if we're faking it. So there's that element, and then there's the overdone confidence that we feel like, in, you know, us Aussies, you know, we kind of can see through that pretty quickly. So if you're not being genuine and authentic about yourself and how we show up, then, you know, we see through that. So I think that having that starting point, like I said, of understanding who we are, who we really are, and what we value and what we're about and what's important to us, and then building the confidence to, you know, through understanding our strengths and our self-talk, all of those things that we've talked about, when we use that as the starting point and build the confidence from the inside out, rather than looking at, okay, this is either a program, this is what I've been taught, this is a role model that perhaps is unattainable, perhaps thinking if I just behave like that, then that'll be what I need to do. If we really build it from the inside out, then it's much more likely to be genuine and authentic and received well by those around us.
Yeah, one of my techniques, which doesn't always work, I have to say, but if someone asks me, can you do this? And I know what I can and can't do. I'm highly aware of my capabilities most of the time. And I'll say, yep, I can do that and I'm really good at it and I've done it 1,000 times before and this is, I know this works. But what I do is balance it with, but I can't do this. You know, I'm no good at this. And so I suppose it's just that balance of, yes, I'm really good at this, but I'm really bad at that. And that just sort of balances out the conversation and, you know, causes a few people to laugh as well, which sort of eases a little bit of that strain.
Yeah, totally. And I think, you know, saying yes to things is part of that, actually, putting yourself out of your comfort zone a little bit as well. But what I also hear from what you're saying there is being able to be vulnerable about, you know, what we're not so good at, and that authenticity and realness in confidence. When we can bring vulnerability to that, then I think that just makes it all the more real.
Yeah, and that, making fun of yourself. I always say I make fun of myself before I give other people a chance to do that. And that's that really authentic, relatable human side of it. Now, you've put all these thoughts into a book, and I'm holding it in my little hand now, The Power of Real Confidence, Learn How to Lead to Your Full Potential. And I love this. Step up, stand up, speak up, show up. Is this your first book, Michelle?
It is my first book.
Well,
yes.
Congratulations! Cause it's an enormous achievement, I've had enough to read to get a sense of it, and I love all the bits in it, and the bits about confidence. There's some really good practical tips and tricks of what to do, and one of the ones I love was the confidence barometer. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. It's because confidence waxes and wanes for us through our life, it's important that we have practices, I suppose, or disciplines that we're able to just reflect from time to time on where our confidence is at. Because when it's low, we know that we can make limiting choices. You know, we might not say yes to that project or that new job opportunity because we're just thinking that we're not quite ready for it. We might try to over perfect our work because it's not quite right yet. So being able to step back and reflect on where is my confidence at? If it's high, then, or if I'm feeling really good, then what is it? What are some of the things that's contributed to that? If it's low, then what's going on for me? So rather than, you know, be 6 months down the track and you've had 6 months of feeling like your confidence is really low and you've been beating yourself up and making limiting choices, being able to catch yourself and assess where you're at and go, okay, what do I need to do about this?
And what I liked about it the most was confidence, I think, is talked about. It's almost all or nothing. You're either confident or you're not confident. And I loved the fact that you looked at it like a barometer, that it is fluid, that it can be up and down. And you can have some days, it's like anything. You know, you have some days where you're feeling good, other days you don't feel like you're on your game, whatever it is. But confidence comes under that. And I love the fact you've said here, confidence is really in a complete level state, no matter how hard we try to sustain our behavioural changes. And I think acknowledging that, accepting that, and then coming up with some, I suppose, using, having a toolbox that you can actually then use for days that you're either feeling good or feeling bad.
Yeah, totally. And when before I started writing the book, because I didn't actually think I would write a how-to book, you know, how do you go about building confidence, but I talked to most of my clients and many people who I've been working with over a long period of time, and I really got a very strong sense from them that it's not just what is confidence, what does it mean, why is it important, but actually what do you do about it? Mm. How do you actually build confidence? How do you sustain confidence? How do you do that in an authentic way? So it was the how-to that was missing from a lot of this work.
Yeah, no, I think it's really good, and it leads into, I just wanted to very quickly touch on, I noticed you're currently studying positive psychology at the moment, which is a real recent movement. I think it was 1998 or late 90s. Martin Seligman, who I'm a huge fan of, and anyone who's wanting to know a bit more about positive psychology can see Seligman's work and a few other outstanding thought leaders that he's collaborated with, and there's some wonderful information available on positive psychology. What led you to go down that path, Michelle?
I love his work as well, but I really love the overarching philosophy with positive psych around you get much better bang for your buck when you focus on your strengths rather than your weaknesses. Mm. So I loved that. And it was, if I can just tell you a little story about me in the writing of the book, because I didn't particularly want to write. English has never been that great. It wasn't my best subject. I didn't, you know, love it at school. And I was about a third of the way through the writing, and I did a strength profile for myself. I was doing some work with clients, and writing came up as a weakness. And I thought, and I struggled, you know, I set Fridays aside for writing, and I did Pilates in the morning, then went for a coffee, and then I get to the afternoon and think, oh, I don't really want to write. Mm. So it wasn't a surprise, it came up as a weakness, but I had narrator come up as a unrealized strength. And so I just took a totally different approach to the writing of the book, where I told stories at the start of each chapter, and it really got me into the flow of writing. So, you know, that to me, that's the whole philosophy of positive psychology, really understand what are your strengths and what are you great at. And if you start with that and leverage that, then we can do the same work but in a much better way.
That I love it. Storytelling. I've got someone on a bit later on the program talking about the power of storytelling. And so thank you for that lovely little segue into probably our next guest after you. But Michelle Sale's book, The Power of Real Confidence, Learn How to Lead to Your Full Potential. It's a great read. Congratulations on your first book. It's a great achievement and very clever the way that you put it together. Now, anyone listening would like to know a bit more about Michelle. She's on Twitter, she's on LinkedIn, she's on Facebook, and michellesales.com.au, all easy.
Thanks, Jackie.
Terrific.
Great talking to you.
Lovely talking to you. Thank you, Michelle. You're listening to Taking Care of Business right here on RDL PFM. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Taking Care of Business, to our human-to-human show today that, of course, was only human. Our next guest works with teams globally, with the likes of Amazon, Pepsi and McDonald's, just to name a few, to discover and implement ways to make our workplaces more human, and has written a book aptly titled How to Speak Human. Welcome to the show, Jen Jackson.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. Now, let's start right from the obvious start, I suppose, or the obvious question. How do you get the best from humans that you work with?
Oh, well, I mean, that's a big one to open, but to give the really short answer, I think it's to acknowledge and to treat them as humans rather than as cogs in a system or resources to be used up and spat out the other end. So, yeah, start by acknowledging that wonderful fleshy bag of meat and bones and emotions that we call human beings, and work out how best to talk to them.
Yeah, look, I think that's a really good answer. So with the rise of the digital age, I've found that with this rise of technology and the digital environment that we're now living in or, you know, trying to navigate, I think it's actually refocused the importance of human-to-human relationships. What's your view?
Yeah, I really agree with that, and that we've never been more connected but disconnected from each other at the same time. I think everyone's probably got that story of being out for dinner or having friends over and you look around and suddenly realise that you're connected to technology but not necessarily to each other, and, you know, people are already implementing those leave your phone at the door sort of rules when you are interacting with other humans. But, yeah, as a reaction to that, there is a movement about bringing more human back, which is really great to see. But I think there's also a little bit of the lost art of how we actually do it.
Yeah, now, is it an art? Or is it, do you think it's an art? Or do you think that we're born like that? Is it a survival thing? Is it something that we've got ingrained in us and that we just need to tap back into?
Yeah, great question. I think we're all born with it. We are all humans, and it should come as natural as nudity in nature, which isn't always necessarily looked upon with favour. But I think what's happened is that because of our education systems, and then we go through, you know, uni, and then we step into our jobs, and we take on all the norms and the rituals and the culture that's there, and that way of communicating in a less than human way, in a more transactional way, is something that we learn. So I think there's art in that we have to relearn some of those skills and how to get back there and be given the permission to act in that way as well.
Yeah. Do you think, from your experience, do you think more people are starting to pick up the phone? And do you think they're having more coffee meetings? I'm seeing this rise in the coffee meetings. You know, let's go and have a coffee and let's have a chat rather than send an email or.
Who doesn't love a coffee?
Well, that's true. I mean, I think people are starting to go, you know, well, let's do the face-to-face thing. You know, let's get some emails maybe to start with, and then we go face-to-face. But then time's always an issue. So I think, but there are ways that we can save time. I don't know. What's your view?
Yeah, I don't know if I've seen a trend towards that. I think there's still a lot of the companies that we work with where, you know, because of being so global and having teams that are spread out across the world, that it is really difficult to have those face-to-face. But what we are finding is that those big occasions throughout the year where everyone might get brought together for a conference or a summit or a workshop or a think tank are even more important because they do allow people to connect in that face-to-face way, but then get supported through technology through other parts of the year with, you know, conferencing and video conferencing and phone calls. But there isn't anything like a face-to-face chat with somebody where you do have that connection, the power of touch, even a shaking of hand or a high five, as long as it's appropriate touch, is a great way to build connections a whole lot faster with people.
Yeah, well, I've certainly seen a rise in the growth of networking. I've seen a rise in conferences. So there was, you know, if even 5 years ago, webinars was the thing. You know, everyone's doing it was Skype, now Zoom. But then I've seen the last sort of 12 months, 18 months, I've certainly seen a rise in the amount of conferences and people going and taking the time out to do that. And so, which is, I think, really, really hopeful. I think that's a really positive. And you called it a movement. I hadn't thought of it like that, but I think it is a movement. I really like that you've done that. Now, how is confidence related to that? Earlier on, our first guest on the show today was, I don't know if you know her, Michelle Sales, and she's just written a book called The Power of Real Confidence and how important confidence is and how powerful it is when you actually, particularly in business, speaking human to human. What's your opinion on that?
I think for leaders, having the confidence to be able to engage with somebody else using those human skills, your confidence, it has to be a part of it. But I think inherently anyone should be able to do it if we just remember those fundamentals of what makes us tick and what makes us connect. So things like communicating with purpose, considering empathy, being authentically true to yourself is going to, that's the way forward, rather than, I guess, pumping yourself up and being sure that you can do it. I think how to speak human and speaking more human is probably just getting back to who we are, really.
Yeah, we've lost sight of that a little bit. I must admit, on the front of your book, there was something that grabbed my attention and actually was the word attention. I think it's the most, and I write a bit about this, I think it's the most undervalued resource in business. Engagement gets far too much attention, where the actual concept of attention itself, you've got to get someone's attention before you can do anything else. And I noticed you've got attention, engagement and influence, which I quite like that order. So tell us a little bit about how we can go about getting people's attention.
Yeah, well, it's such an important one, and I think you hit the nail on the head that it is the most important resource to consider, and like time and like, you know, money, it should be used wisely and should be considered when we are developing strategies and initiatives that we're trying to get out there. How do we get attention in this incredibly noisy, busy world where everyone's competing for it? So how do we get attention? Well, we've got to wake people up. We've got to use all those wonderful human skills and those human tactics to break through and cut through. So, you know, some of the things that we write about in the book, you can use curiosity to get attention. You can use surprise to break the mundane of the everyday and throw something in that makes people take attention. And then once you've got that attention, then what do you do with it? You use visual to get people's attention. I don't know if you've come across an infographic or something as a way of communicating, say, safety scores back to the rest of the business. If we present them using a visual, we're going to have far more uptake and understanding and retention than if we were to use, say, a spreadsheet or a death by PowerPoint.
Yes, too much text. Our visual our visual side of our brain is so dominant, and it's something that we need to be using a lot more of that. So I'm glad you brought that up. Now, touching on curiosity, I'm always curious about curiosity, of course. I was curious in your book, you have 11 proven strategies, 23 tactics, and 15 real world examples. I have to firstly ask, how did you come up with those numbers?
Curiouser. Well, what was interesting, we were really adamant that when we wrote this book, we weren't going to make it fit into a nice little box. We were going to write what was needed, no more and no less. So I think sometimes when authors are writing a book, they go, okay, it needs to be split across three sections and it's going to have six chapters in each, and that's my framework. We wanted to approach it a bit more holistically and go, okay, what do we actually want to say? And then at the end of it, that's just what the numbers were. That was set out.
Okay,
so
all right.
No great strategy.
Right, okay. So there's no pattern. I know that humans are terrific pattern matchers, and
I
proved that. I was going, what are those numbers for then? So 11 proven strategies, 23 tactics, that's good, 15 real-world examples, and I really like the examples because it's all very well. We can talk strategies and tactics, but to bring it back to a story that we can actually relate to, I think, is really important. And the other bit I liked, you mentioned, was the importance of simplicity. We do tend to overcomplicate things when we don't need to.
Yeah, and I think you've just said the right word there, is that it is complication that we're not looking for, and that sometimes that gets confused with complexity, whereas complexity is beautiful, complexity is life, complexity is human, but it doesn't need to come at the expense of simplicity. So we can always take something that's complex, and through great communication we can develop enough understanding with somebody else to get them to a point where they either want to learn more or they know enough to do what they have to do.
Yeah, well, congratulations. And also congratulations because you actually co-authored this book with your husband, Dougal. And I think that's probably another conversation that I'll just, if you can put that on hold, we'll have to have you back another time because I think that's a real achievement. And I think it's a great practical approach to any communication challenge that businesses have. It's a really good place to start. So How to Speak Human by Jackson & Jackson, available where all books are sold. And if people want to find out a bit more about the work that you do, Jen, and the work that Dougal does, I assume that you are on LinkedIn. What other social media channels are you?
Yeah, LinkedIn's probably the best one for us. Otherwise, you can jump on and check us out at www.jaxzyn.com.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time, Jen Jackson.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, bye. You're listening to Taking Care of Business. We are trying to improve how to speak human. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Taking Care of Business. We're talking about human to human today, and that, of course, was human nature. And we've discussed how to speak human. We've talked about the role of confidence. And our next guest is going to complete this important business trifecta by not forgetting the customer or client experience. He is the highest performing speaker with the CEO Institute on Customer Experience and Culture. And he joins us today to talk about the client revolution. Welcome, Daryl Hardage.
Thank you, Jackie. How are you?
Really good. Good speaking with you. Now, I loved this concept that you talk about, this new measurement of service value. Tell us a bit more about that.
Well, most of the things in business are geared towards customer satisfaction. And even when you talk to a lot of businesses, they'll say they have a high focus on service excellence. But if you ask them how do they measure that to know they're on track, they'll talk about satisfaction. The challenge with satisfaction is that it's basically just giving people what they expect and what they want. Mm. And in this market, you've got to go beyond just giving people what they're paying for, because as a minimum, we should always get what we expect. And that's really what satisfaction is measured against.
Yeah, I love the story. You tell a story about a billboard. Share that with us.
Well, yeah, recently I was driving down the freeway and they had, I can't even remember the company, it didn't interest me that much, but it was more the catch line, you'll be 100% satisfied. Mm. And I was saying to my wife, who's reading the billboard, I said, well, here's my first question, as opposed to what? 80% satisfied? 85? So 100% satisfaction guarantee is basically saying, and this is the craziness of it, is basically me saying to you, Jackie, you spend $10,000 with me on a bathroom renovation and I'll guarantee that you'll get what you expect.
Yeah, big deal.
Big deal. Exactly, big deal.
Yeah, so, and that satisfaction, it's such a basic low-level expectation. And so I think, you know, we talked about this concept of customer delight, but you talk about customer appreciation. I think that word is so much more emotional and so much more connected with what customers want to feel.
Yes. Well, there is a real, just going back quickly to satisfaction. Satisfaction is, it's something that you assess left brain. It's like, I got what I wanted, tick the boxes. And it's sort of short-term memory as well, because there's so many businesses we transact with. And I often say to people, you know, if you look at your credit card statement, can you remember everywhere you went? And very few people can. Mm. And yet you spend a whole lot of money there because you just had this short-term memory experience. The one thing that we've learned from all the research we've done is that when you go above the standard of 8 out of 10 service experience, which is what satisfaction is, and you deliver that really fabulous 10 out of 10 experience, you then go into this whole new realm of engagement with your customers, and that's where they truly appreciate the effort and the service and the time you've taken, and it's a heart connection, and it goes into long-term memory. So if you think of your own habits, there'll be businesses that you are very, very loyal to. And the ones that we tend to find we're loyal to, it's not about the price. It's, in fact, usually we pay more for those businesses. It's because of how we connect with them, how they know our names, they remember us, there's a spark in their eyes, there's greeting, you actually feel like a friend. And so appreciation in a service culture, and a team culture and service environment, it's knowing exactly how to build those bridges with people. And when you've achieved that, it's just extraordinary. The loyalty you get, first of all, and the massive amount of referrals you get on the back of that.
Yeah, now you mentioned your interviews. Now, I know that you've done here, and in my notes here, you've completed over 750,000 end-user interviews. How long did that take you to do?
That's going over 10 years now.
Right. And were they all qualitative or quantitative, or were they one-on-one?
Well, over half a million of them are all phone-based.
Right. Okay. So, and the
others were strategic. They're in other countries, so they were different. But the key thing is we want to talk to people on the phone because then you can dialogue with people and you get to really understand how you can hear emotion through the phone. And when you really, for any business out there that's looking to survey their customers and get feedback, please do it on the phone. Don't send people emails because we're all sick of that. And emails and text messages, they'll tell you what people think, but they'll never tell you why they think it. And if you get people on the phone and have a talk to them, you'll be able to understand why they feel the way they feel, whether it's good or bad, and then you'll be able to act on it with more accuracy.
And you mentioned it was a global research project?
One of our clients, there's like over 200,000 we've done for them, which is all around the world, and that's quite an in-depth process where it's back and forth. But the things that I've written about in my book are based upon we have our own call team here in Melbourne, and it's based upon our phone-based research in Melbourne where we deal with companies that are, the biggest one we do does over $1 billion in revenue, and we deal all the way down to the SME market. And the key to it is, and it's interesting, that out of all the interviews we've done, the thing that people remember the most is how the team supported them. If they talk about your products or your service as the number one reason, you don't have a heart connection to them. When they talk about friendly and helpful, understanding my needs, helpful and obliging, trust, communication, that's all about your people. And when they're the reasons why they're loyal or they're the reasons why they refer you, you've got a very strong connection to them.
Now, a nice segue. It is cool. It's great. I thought that was wonderful. I was about to ask you what the insights were, but I didn't need to because you shared that very generously. And it was a nice segue to your book, Darryl, The Client Revolution, Smashing the Loyalty Myth and Having the Edge. But you've also got your number one international bestseller was The 10 Commandments of Client Appreciation. Thou shalt create loyalty, a step-by-step guide to number one position, and they're both really great that you go into much more detail from these end-user interviews. Is that right, that you use that as your inspiration, as the basis for these books?
Absolutely. It's based on all the research we've done. The first one is more structural. It's based around what companies need to do in their structure. Mm. And I do a lot of keynotes on this, and I had people say to me around the team training and so on that, we need this in a book, so hence the Ten Commandments are basically the 10 key principles I cover. And the 10 commandments are around culture, around people. And at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how good your product is, unless you've got a great team of people, you're not going to have loyalty to it. People are everything.
Yeah, that's great. Now, with your keynoting, I'm just curious, is there a particular popular theme or trend now that maybe it's shifted? So 5 years ago when you were speaking, you might have been speaking about everyone wanted a customer service keynote. Now it's sort of twisting a bit more towards culture. Or is there any common threads or trends that you've noticed?
Yeah, look, a lot of in marketing now, it's all around the CX, which is the customer experience, or the UX, the user experience. The one thing that I think is, it's just another fluffy name sometimes. I'm a big believer that really high quality service and engagement with customers has never gone out of fashion and never will. And one of the things that's interesting here is a lot of companies, they're saying their challenges are the online situation where people, can buy it online, et cetera, et cetera. And it's making it harder and harder to do business. However, we have clients that have really nailed their service experience, and they're having a boom time, and they're not discounting, because we will all pay a little bit more for brilliant service. We want price if we're just getting what we pay for, which is satisfaction. But if you have a heartfelt appreciation for a business, you will pay a little bit more for that. And that's where the companies take the time to understand, first of what they stand for and what their customers really love them for, and then make sure their team understand that and they have a training process so that they can predictably deliver that. You pretty much won the game. And the key thing to this is what we always say is you must obsess over your customers, not over your competitors.
Yeah.
If you obsess over your customers and learn what they want and take the feedback and get out on the floor and speak with people, you'll really get to understand what they're looking for. But so many businesses are more obsessed on their competitors and what they're doing, they're losing focus on their own customer.
You know what, Daryl? I would pay more for petrol if I could drive to a petrol station and someone put the petrol in the car for me, like they used to do in the good old days.
Yeah, well... I could remember that too, so that says something, doesn't it?
There you go, yeah. But you know what? I've done my own little, you know, my little research project, and particularly women. There's every woman, women I speak to, all say the same thing. They would pay extra, and the men mightn't like, you know, mightn't mind the smell of petrol on your fingers, but it does my head in, and particularly if you're dressed up going somewhere and a bit drops on your shoe or something. So I'm just waiting for that to be disrupted again. But I think I should be holding my breath. Anyway, Daryl Hardidge, thank you so much for your time today. Your book, The Client Revolution: Smashing the Loyalty Myth and Having the Edge, and of course your number one international bestseller, congratulations, The 10 Commandments of Client Appreciation. I assume it's wherever you can buy books, people can access those?
Yes, they can, or they're on Amazon, which is usually the easy way people
get. Yeah, Amazon's the easy. Now, anyone that's been listening to you today, and just to remind our listeners, we've been chatting with Daryl Hardidge, and if they want to follow you or come and see you keynote and wonder what you're up to, what are the best platforms? I'm assuming you're on LinkedIn?
Yes, on LinkedIn, and also just go to our website, Saguity, SAGUITY.com, and we can easily get in touch from there.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for your time today, Daryl.
That's an absolute pleasure, Jackie. Thank you.